Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for July 2015. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. On June 22, 2015, the Supreme Court of the United States handed down its decision in Kimball and Marvel Entertainment. When you hear Marvel Entertainment, you probably immediately think Spider-Man, in which case, for this case, you'd be right. But this wasn't a trademark case or even a copyright case. It was a patent case dealing with a children's web blaster toy. But the case dealt less with patent issues than with stare decisis, and whether it was time for the court to review its jurisprudence on patent licensing terms. Marco Quinna is a partner with Foley Hoag in Boston, Massachusetts, and is involved in commercial litigation with a focus on intellectual property and antitrust disputes. Mr. Quinna and his partner Don Ware recently wrote a case comment on the Kimball and Marvel case with a few suggestions as to how to work around its findings in various patent licensing situations. I spoke with Mr. Quinna from his office in Boston. Hello, Marco.
Hi, Don.
So what were the facts of Kimball against Marvel?
So Kimball versus Marvel is an interesting case, and the facts are probably more interesting than your typical Supreme Court case, especially to lay people. This is a case that involved Spider-Man toys. So these little toys that you put on your hand, they've got a little, they were called the Web Blaster, and you shoot these little strings of foam out them, you can pretend to be Spider-Man. So it's a sort of fun little toy. And the facts of the case, the Supreme Court makes the facts fairly simple. As I'll get into in a second, the facts were slightly more complicated, and I'll go into some of the facts the Supreme Court didn't talk about. But in terms of how the Supreme Court sets up the case is about a man named Kimball, an inventor, and he had a patent to this web blaster idea, these Spider-Man toys. And he ended up licensing his patent to Marvel for a payment and a 3% royalty on future sales of the web blaster. And there was no termination date on this license, so Marvel was going to pay a 3% royalty on these products under this agreement forever, basically. At the time, neither party knew of any rule that would prevent them from doing that. They both admitted that during the course of litigation. And there was this rule out there that we'll get into that says that you can't require royalties for use of a patent after a patent has expired. And the parties later got into a dispute, and Marvel found out about this rule and then sought to stop paying royalties when the patent expires. So that's the case as it's laid out by the Supreme Court. The case is actually a little more complicated if you look into the Ninth Circuit opinion, where the Ninth Circuit applied this rule. And the Ninth Circuit case, what happened was in the early 1990s, Kimball had come with Marvel. At the time, he actually didn't have a patent. He had a patent application. And he met with Marvel, and he said, I've got this idea for these web blaster toys. And during this meeting, Kimball said that Marvel agreed that they pay him if they ever used his idea. Marvel, during the meeting, declines to use Kimball's idea. And Marvel then makes a web blaster, and Kimball is unhappy about this, and he sues them for both patent infringement and for breach of this oral contract that he alleged that Marvel had entered into with him. Well, during the litigation, Kimball's patent infringement claim was dismissed on summary judgment, so that actually was dismissed out of the case. And the contract claim went all the way to the jury. And the jury actually found that there was an oral agreement that the contract had been breached by Marvel going ahead and selling this web blaster. The jury awarded a 3.5% royalty to Kimball on future net product sales of these web blasters. Both parties appealed, and then during the appeal, they both settled. So they entered into a settlement agreement in the early 2000s, I think, is when the settlement agreement happened. And as part of that settlement agreement, Kimball signed his patent to Marvel with releases, and Marvel agreed to pay 3% royalty of net sales, which is, if you think back, so the jury award is 0.5% less than what the jury had awarded Kimball. So what happened is in the district court case, Kimball had come out with a victory from the jury, awarding him a 3.5% royalty for breach of the oral agreement and no patent infringement claim because he had lost that on summary judgment. They both appealed, and then he comes out of the settlement with a license, essentially, to Marvel, where he has given them his patent by signing it, and they've agreed to pay him 3%, and they're paying a little less than the jury had awarded. Both parties admitted, as I mentioned, that they weren't aware of any rule at the time to prevent them from doing that, which is actually typical of cases. And this is a rule that was announced in a case called Brulot versus Ties Company, which was decided in the late 1960s. And that case says that a licensor cannot require payment for the use of his patent after the patent has expired. And neither party had known of this rule. And so they didn't make any provision for it in the agreement. After they entered the settlement agreement, there was a period of peace for about half a decade or so, where Kimball was paid over $6 million in royalties for sales of this web blaster. In the mid-2000s or so, the parties got into a squabble over other provisions of the agreement, and during this period of time, Kimball's patent, which was now Marvel's patent, had expired. And they couldn't resolve these disputes that had arisen about some of the what was required to be paid on what products. And so Kimball sues Marvel for breach of the settlement agreement, and Marvel counterclaims for a declaration that they're not required to pay post-expiration royalties under this Brulot rule. And ultimately, the district court agreed with Marvel and held that under the Brulot rule, the post-expiration patent royalties were invalid. And the case goes to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit, which recites the facts I've just told you about, very reluctantly held that Brulot applied. And this is actually the second time the Ninth Circuit has reluctantly applied Brulot. There was a case in 2007 where they did the same thing, as they upheld a invalidity of a post-expiration royalty under Brulot, but it did so making very clear that they thought the Supreme Court should look at the case. They did so again in the Kimball case. The Ninth Circuit's view was that the patents were, as the court put it, vastly overshadowed by what were the likely non-patent rights that were more interest to the parties. And they thought that the patent part of the agreement was a sort of a secondary piece of it, and really what the parties were more interested in was resolving the 3.5% royalty that Kimball had gotten from his victory in front of the jury on the contract claim. And the Ninth Circuit was one in many of a series of courts and economists and commentators who criticize this Brulot rule for a variety of reasons, sometimes harshly. And Kimball sought certiorari from the Supreme Court. And the question he presented, and it's important to think about the Supreme Court case in view of the question he presented. The question he presented was, should Brulot be overruled? In other words, should the court essentially discard it entirely and go forward with some other principle? I think that's one reason why the Supreme Court didn't really go into the more nuanced facts about the case and how there was this contract claim in play, because Kimball actually didn't present the question they really required to deal with it. He sort of presented the question, should just Brulot be gone? And that's really what went before the court.
And in brief, what did the Supreme Court decide?
So looking at the question presented, the Supreme Court decided that Brulot should not be overruled, and that a patent holder cannot charge royalties for the use of his invention after his patent terms expired. So that is basically the holding of the case. The court primarily relies on stare decisis, which for the non-lawyers out there just means that a court will follow a prior decision, even if it's wrong, unless there is a good reason not to follow it. If you need some special circumstances not to follow. And the Kimball decision is largely a discussion of the rule of stare decisis and whether or not Kimball had made a showing that the court should depart from its prior precedent. Ultimately, the court, quoting Spider-Man himself, held that, with great power comes great responsibility, as famously said in the Spider-Man comics. And they held that we need to follow our prior law. People have relied on it. It's been around for decades, and Kimball hasn't given us a good enough reason to depart from it. The United States had actually supported keeping Brulot in place against citing stare decisis. The United States was an amicus in the case. And that's ultimately where the court went.
So going back to the Brulat decision, what was the basis of the Brulat decision?
Well, the basis of the Brulat decision, this is this can be a matter of some debate, but the way the Supreme Court characterizes it in Kimball is that once a patent expires, the invention should be free to everyone, for everyone to use, including people who have licensed that invention. Therefore, if you're paying somebody for use of your patent after the patent has expired, a court simply will not enforce that requirement to pay, because what it's effectively doing is giving the patentee the ability to require payment for something that essentially no longer exists because the patent has expired.
Now, I understand Kimball was arguing that there should be more of a rule of reason test be applied to situations like this. Can you explain what that argument was all about?
So when Kimball said that the Brulat should be overruled, well, that obviously would be leave a vacuum because there would be no rule, and so he had to propose some alternative rule. And what he proposed is the court apply the rule of reason, which you find in antitrust law, which is really a rule that looks at the reasonableness of the overall transaction. It's more complicated than that, but to keep things simple, that's roughly what it's all about. The court felt that was a little bit more complicated. They felt that the Brulat rule was fairly simple to apply. And again, that's debatable, and I'll get into that in a second. The court felt that Brulat was simple, and it didn't want to inject a more complicated area of antitrust law, case law, into the analysis. So they declined to do that. But who knows if they would have done so if they had decided to overrule Brulat. But ultimately, they decided not to overrule Brulat, so they didn't need to deal with what the alternative test would be.
The court seemed to characterize Brulat as a pretty bright-line test. I'm just going to quote from part of the judgment. Does it, quote, provide royalties for post-expiration use of a patent, ? If not, no problem. If it does, no dice. Are you saying it's a little more complicated than that?
Well, when we talk about... It's the question it asks is fairly simple, but the when you actually start thinking about what it actually means, it can get a little bit more complicated. But the court does say that Brulat is, I think the way the court puts it, is simplicity itself to apply. One way I've said it is that what Kimball provides is it's almost distills Brulat down to some sort of essence, an eau de Brulat, if you will. Mm-hmm. And the question, if you really wanted to sit down and think about, if you're a person thinking about a patent license, for example, either you're drafting one or you're looking at one and trying to decide, is this a problem? What the court says is, and this is just a quote from the case, a court need only ask whether a licensing agreement provides royalties for post-expiration use of a patent. That's the question. Does this licensing agreement provide royalties for post-expiration use of a patent? Mm-hmm. And then, if not, no problem. If so, no dice. So you can actually make a nice little table where you've got the top column is if not, and if so, and no problem, no dice. And so what you're really doing is asking yourself two questions, though, if you untangle what the Supreme Court is asking there. The first question is this royalty for a payment for use of a patent? And the second question is it for post-expiration use of a patent? If the answer is no to either of those questions, then the royalty might be okay. Mm-hmm. If the answer is yes to both, then you may have, as the court puts it, a problem.
Okay. Now, you've done a case comment on Kimball and Marvel, and the Supreme Court themselves said there were ways to work around Brulat to have royalties paid after a patent expires but not run afoul of Brulat. What are those scenarios?
So the court actually gives four separate scenarios where it is examples where Brulat can be circumvented. And as you'll see, it's actually fairly easy to circumvent Brulat if you know about it. The court lists four, and the first of these is, remember, the rule only prevents post-expiration royalties for use of the patent, right? Mm-hmm. So one way you can get around Brulat is to defer royalty payments it actually allows you to defer payments for use during the life of the patent, so they're paid after the patent expires.
Use now, pay later.
Correct. So it'd be like, you know, if when you're buying a house, you know, you can, you know, a patent doesn't last 30 years, but let's say you're buying a house, you could get a 30-year mortgage, and so you effectively amortize the in-life payments you're making over a longer term, 30 years, 50 years, but of course you'd have to make it clear that that's what you're doing, because if you don't, there might be arguments later that that the payments after the patent is expired are actually for post-expiration use. So you can say that if the agreement is clear that the post-expiration payments are tied to and accrue during the life of the patent. Like the simple example would be, let's say instead of requiring a 3% royalty during the life of a patent, you'd require a 1% royalty on sales during the life of the patent, but then the party would continue to pay that 1% tied to pre-expiration sales after the patent has expired. Mm-hmm. For another 20 years or something. So they're effectively paying the same amount, and it's tied to the same pre-expiration sales, but it's just stretched out over a long period of time. Another example is a case that actually happened before Kimball was ever decided, and it's a case in the District of Delaware. Judge Robinson decided this case, Bayer versus Housey Pharmaceuticals. And that was a case where a defendant sought to invalidate a patent that was tied to screening. It was about screening of drug candidates. So it was a patent for finding new drugs or pharmaceuticals, and the defendant in that case argued that the patentee had been licensing this patent out and requiring people to pay royalties even after expiration for any drugs that they found using this technique. And the court actually said it wasn't, because they said, look, this patent is all about finding drugs, and the licensees found these drugs during the life of the patent. So the requirement to pay royalties after the patent expired wasn't a requirement to pay royalties for use of the for post-expiration use of the patent, was actually a requirement pay royalties for pre-expiration use of the patent, because that's when they found the drug. The drugs themselves presumably were not patented. It was just the method of finding them. And so that's another example where you might have a royalty payment that is it occurs after expiration, but is actually for use during the life of the patent.
Okay. Now, I understand one of the other thoughts the Supreme Court had dealt with where several patents were licensed. What was that scenario?
Right. And so if this has long been the rule, so Kimball doesn't say anything new here. And again, because Kimball is declining to overrule Brulote, arguably everything Kimball says about Brulote is not new, because it's just saying we're not going to overrule Brulote. That was the holding. But Brulote itself actually says that if you're royalty extends to last to expire a patent that's licensed, then you're okay. So what Kimball says is that you're allowed to, if multiple patents are licensed, to have the royalties run until the last one expires. So even if the product is really only covered by one of the patents, it is not cut off when that patent expires. It can continue until the last licensed patent expires.
Would it be wise in a circumstance like that to adjust the royalty rate to have it decline as some of the patents expire, or do you think you can get away with a flat rate over the whole course of the license?
You could probably get away with a flat rate over the course of the license as long as there are still patents in force. Mm. There's something called a step down, which is more applicable to the next scenario the Supreme Court lays out, where you're talking about non-patent rights.
Okay. Well, let's talk about non-patent rights. How do you use those to get around the Brulote rule?
So the court says you can always have royalties payable after patent expires for non-patent rights, such as trade secret or know-how, and it's of course common to people licensed trade secret or know-how. In fact, there is no Brulote problem at all if the royalty is for a non-patent right. Like for example, let's say the patentee is a patent to chairs, right? And you've agreed to pay a royalty on tables. You don't have a problem with Brulote because the royalty is not based on post-expiration use of the licensee's patent. It's based on something else entirely. You may have trade secrets or know-how relating to tables. Mm-hmm. So the court says that you're allowed to do that. You're allowed to have a royalty to a trade secret, even if later on you patent something related to that trade secret, or you patent some, or yeah, you can do a license to know-how, even if later on, or you have related patents that relate to know-how but aren't necessarily covered by the royalty obligation.
Okay.
But you need to be careful here. And this is something that is the particular trap for them, where you need to be really careful, because where people find themselves in trouble, and there's a bunch of cases about this, is where you have a royalty that requires payment for both patents and non-patent rights. And if you actually think about Kimball's case, it was really that kind of royalty, if you think about it, because really the royalty was not just for the patent rights. It was also for release of this oral contract claim that he had. That's a somewhat unusual situation. It's more common where you might have a royalty where somebody's agreeing to pay a license to a patent and a trade secret's know-how and other things, right? Mm-hmm. And so you might think, well, is there an argument here that, for example, could, in Kimball's case, could he say, well, this patent, this royalty is really about the contract rights, or at least a big chunk of it's about the contract rights? And there's a bunch of cases out there that say, well, under Brulot, we can't look into that. So as long as the royalty is in some part for use of the patent after it's expired, then there's a problem, and the whole royalty goes down. However, if in the agreement the parties make very clear which portions of the royalties are for non-patent rights, then courts have upheld those. There's a famous Supreme Court case called Aronson, where that exactly is what happened. Their patentee the licensee had agreed to pay a royalty of, I can't remember the exact number, but it was something like 5% if a patent ever issued, and then 2.5% if a patent didn't issue. Well, it turns out the patent didn't issue, and the 2.5% was due. And the Supreme Court said that was fine, because you can actually figure out what portion of the royalty is for the non-patent right, the 2.5%, and so there's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you would want to do if you, for example, licensing both patents and trade secrets and know-how, and you wanted a royalty that covered all three, is you want to be pretty clear in your agreement that after the patent expires, the royalty for the non-patent rights would change. And that's what people in the field call a step-down. You would step down the royalty, so you'd say you're required to pay a 5% royalty until the last to expire of the patents, for a license to use trade secrets, know-how, and the patent, and then after the patent expires, you're required to pay 2.5%. If you do that, you've protected yourself. Now, the Kimball case actually doesn't talk about the step-down, and they don't address any argument by Kimball that the royalty is really for the oral contract. And they didn't have to, because that's not the question that Kimball presented. He didn't mm-hmm. present the question that turned on the factual circumstances of this case, or how Brulot should be applied to this case. He just said, should Brulot be overruled? So the court really didn't need to reach that question. But so they didn't discuss the step-down, but the example they give here for an agreement where royalties are payable for a non-patent right does include a step-down. So I think the agreement the court uses as an example is a royalty that requires a license agreement that requires a 5% royalty, and then a 4% royalty after the patent expires for use of trade secrets. And the step-down is actually perhaps the easiest way to avoid a Brulot problem while you're negotiating a license, because you can include that step-down for any non-patent rights, and that does a pretty good job of insulating you from a future Brulot challenge.
Okay. And what was the fourth scenario the Supreme Court suggested?
The fourth scenario was other arrangements like joint ventures or joint ownership, where the parties share the risks and rewards of commercializing an invention. So like, for example, you could have a agreement where the party, and the court doesn't say this, I'm just suggesting things that might fall into this, the court, you might have somebody receiving stock that pays them a dividend over a certain period of time. That's not something that would be a problem. So these joint venture, joint ownership-like situations are things that the court appears to have blessed.
And that scenario at least allows for both parties to benefit accordingly after the patent expires for use of that technology.
Correct.
Okay. So what do you consider as the biggest takeaway from the Kimball and Marble decision?
Well, the biggest takeaway is that people should keep Berlot in mind when structuring their royalty payments. It's a rule that's fairly easy to get around because you can always include a step down. It's not too hard to include a step down. And you should think about it especially when the royalty is based on something other than patent expiration. So if your royalty is based on a period of time that isn't tied to the patent expiring, for example, if it's tied to, say, first commercial sale of a product, or a certain number of years from signing the license agreement, then you need to think about, well, what happens when the patent expires? Should I really need to be worried about that? Should I make sure I have a provision in here that changes the royalty so it makes clear what is being licensed and what is the royalty rate for that? And for people in litigation, it means, or people looking at licenses that are already existing where you may either need to renegotiate them or challenge them, you need to really carefully scrutinize the royalty provisions to determine whether they do require post-expiration royalty payments, because in a way, Berlot has new vigor now that the Supreme Court has declined to overrule it, and there likely will be more litigation on the scope of Berlot and whether something falls into these various categories that the court has suggested are permissible. And so you really want to think about your existing royalties and license agreements to determine whether there might be a Berlot problem there. And of course, if you're negotiating a license, particularly for a patentee, you don't want to be surprised later on. But the other takeaway is that Berlot can be a real trap for the unwary. And this is something that the dissent and the Kimball case really points out, because the court says that the Berlot rule is pretty simple, and talks about how relatively easy it is to circumvent. So that means that if you've got an IP license or a license involves a license agreement that involves a license to a patent, you really should have somebody who is familiar with IP licensing look at it, even if it's a broader business deal. Because as you can see here in the Kimball case, neither side knew about it, and that caused problems. And that's actually how the Berlot rule actually comes up in cases where people don't know about it. And so if you're working on an IP license or any deal that involves a license of a patent, you really should have it scrutinized by sophisticated licensing counsel to make sure that you're not going to be stuck with some unpleasant surprise in the future, particularly for the licensor.
Stuck with unpleasant surprises. That's probably a good note to finish on, with neither of us applying any Spider-Man puns throughout this discussion.
So it's as close as we can get. The Supreme Court has monopolized all the Spider-Man puns, which is, it makes the agreement as a decision worth reading if you're a comic book aficionado, because Justice Kagan, who reportedly is one, put in a lot of little Easter eggs in there, and I think it may be the first Supreme Court decision where you have both the dissent and the majority opinion throwing words around like superpowers and super duper and quoting and citing to comic books. So, but we'll leave the puns and jokes to the court, because they're much better at it than I am.
Yeah, I think, especially when you're in court, you're best to leave the jokes to the judge.
that's true.
Okay, well, thank you very much for these insights, Marco.
Oh, you're welcome.
Marco Quinna is a partner with Foley Hoag in Boston, Massachusetts. For further information on Mr. Quinna's case comment on Kimball and Marvel entitled How Not to Get Snared in Brulot's Web, and for information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.